Welcome to the History of the Cold War podcast, Cold War 2.0, episode 13. I'm your host, Jeff Hoag, and I'm joined by our producer, David Force.
Hello, folks.
As always, this episode is made on or about March the 23rd, so all of our information is pertinent to that time and the time before. We're using open source information to make this episode, so obviously we don't have any insight into classified information or news stories. Where I'm coming at this with my own specific perspective on history, that being the late 20th century and specifically the first Cold War. This is our shortened episode. So if you want to listen to the full episode, please become a Patreon supporter at www.historyofthecoldwarpodcast.com/Patreon or go to our website to check it out there.
Okay. Thank you for that, Jeff. For our 13th episode, we're going to start with the current state of the Ukrainian-Russia war. Talk about what are the politics that are kind of involved and going on. Then we'll switch to force generation. We'll talk about the foreign forces involved. We'll talk about Russia and their force generation, as well as Ukraine's force generation. Then we'll switch our eyes over to the Middle East, talk about what's happening there, and then finish off with Asia. So first, to kick us off, Jeff, if you could give us the current state on the Ukraine-Russia war.
Sure. So the Russian offensive grinds on, but, you know, more or less has very little to show for it for all the effort. There's been continuous fighting around Bakhmut. Bakhmut is now at this point semi-surrounded, but the offensive is bogged down again. It's kind of a stop-and-go process, and this is for a couple of reasons. It seems like one is stiff Ukrainian resistance, and the second is lack of ammunition. We've been seeing, again, a lot of infighting between Wagner Group and the Russian army. Prigozhin has pleaded with Putin to try to send his forces more ammunition, but Putin, from what we understand, is he actually even refusing to speak with him. So he's resorted to using Russian social media to try to get attention, and it's just back and forth. So Russian forces were badly defeated in the south in a place called Volodar. The town is in the south, and basically it threatens Russia's land bridge to Crimea. It's close to the Russian rail lines that are taking supplies into Russian-controlled Crimea, and the Ukrainians are basically using it as a position to shell the Russian trains. And basically, they're trying to stop Russian supplies from coming in. So because of this, the Russians attempted to take the town. So the town is basically situated on high ground with flat fields around it, which is bad for the Russians because basically you could see them coming. So it just turned into a slaughter. The Russians on several occasions tried to advance across this field, and they were just slaughtered. Basically, what happens is we see the Russians. It looks like a moonscape now. The Russians try to advance across this field with landmines, and the Ukrainians just open fire on them with artillery, and they just destroy them. So, a couple of times, the Ukrainians will purposely put a lot of times landmines in the fields around them, but not in the road. So the Russians will try to come down the road, get shelled. You'll see them panic, and then they'll try to move onto the off the road into the landmine fields, and then you see their tanks explode. Sometimes the Russians, you'd see vehicles that had already been previously destroyed, and the Russians still try to drive into the field and hit landmines and get destroyed. So they lost something like an estimated 180 tanks and IFVs in 3 weeks. So it's pretty bad. According to some estimates,
this sounds almost like World War One type fighting.
Yeah, except they're losing IFVs and tanks. So, I mean, yeah, it's just a lot of these troops. They're given orders to try to take this position. I think that they don't. A lot of times, it seems like they don't have a lot of equipment to take out landmine fields. They're also obviously operating under enemy fire as well. So it seems like a lot of the troops are panicking because a lot of these troops now are newly conscripted troops. And I think that the biggest problem is Russia just lacks air cover, right? Because I think in a normal Western army kind of sense, they would just try to bring in air power, right, to take out these guns and try to silence them or keep enough fire on it for your troops to advance. But that's just generally not the case in this scenario. Because the Russian Air Force just has been so lackluster in this conflict. You know, according to some estimates, Russia's losing something like 7-1 in their current offensive. So just not going well. They have tried some other newer tactics, one of which is reminiscent of basically just kind of like car bombs, except they're remotely controlled. So they've been loading up some APCs with explosives, and they've been trying to drive them remotely into Ukrainian positions and setting them off. But again, relatively speaking, they've still been taking a lot of heavy casualties. Ukraine recently as well has been winning a lot of counter-battery fights. And these are basically artillery duels with the Russians as of late, as they are able to fire and move on average quicker than the Russians can respond. The Russians are still firing more artillery shells, but not as much as they were back in the summer. So they still have a slight advantage in terms of numbers. But the Ukrainians, it seems like, have a greater advantage in accuracy. There's been a lot of Ukrainian partisan activity around Mariupol, which is, again, in that Ukrainian land bridge in between Russia and Crimea. And they've been causing some serious damage to Russian logistics. In December, they took out a major bridge. And in January, they destroyed an ammunition dump. The Russians claim as well that there was Ukraine made a border incursion near Bryansk, and they say that they killed one Russian civilian, and Russia responded with a massive wave of cruise missile attacks. They launched some 95 cruise missiles on basically Ukrainian civilian infrastructure. 34 missiles were shot down, but Ukrainian power and water services were temporarily down. Anti-Putin Russian forces actually ultimately claimed responsibility for the attack. Ukraine denied any responsibility in the cross-border incursion, though, and said it was basically a false Russian provocation. There are rumors that a Ukrainian drone has also attacked the suburbs around Moscow. There was a gas compressor station that exploded. So there are some rumors that was actually the work of a Ukrainian drone. And there was also as well inside of Russia, again, an FSB building in Rostov on the Don, which is an area bordering Ukraine, that was also attacked and set on fire. So it seems that, you know, again, the conflict, which we predicted back at the beginning, is starting to spill over into Russia, and given that they're next door neighbors. This is also, you know, on another occasion, Russian air defenses took down 3 Ukrainian drones around Belgrade, again inside of Russia. And as a result of all these air attacks, it's basically forcing the Russians to pull back their air defenses from their troops and deploy them to defend their infrastructure within Russia. Basically the same thing that the Russians did to the Ukrainians earlier in the war, when they started using their cruise missiles to hit their civilian infrastructure. There have been reports of the Russians using more precision guided bombs recently. However, we've also seen complaints from the Russian side that they only have limited supply of these weapons. Russians have also been complaining about the lack of intelligence and issues around communication still. Also, in big news recently, Russia forced down a U.S. Predator drone over the Black Sea, and they're attempting to recover it.
Jeff, really quick to that Predator drone, it seemed to be kind of big news at the time. What was your make of the incident, and what do you think impact it has in kind of wider Russian thing?
So I do have. I don't. This is totally unsubstantiated. But my theory is this. So we know, and I was going to talk about this a little bit later. So we had learned recently that Russia has been giving Javelin and Stinger missiles to Iran to try to reverse engineer them. Iran has had some success with reverse engineering U.S. technology in the past. They were able to reverse engineer TOW missiles and basically make their own copy of the TOW missile. So my theory is obviously technological. I think one of the big things we've learned in this war is that technologically, especially in regards to drones and some other technical equipment, Iran has been really ahead of the curve. They've actually been supplying Russia with drones and such. And it looks like, you know, over the years, we know that because of sanctions and whatnot, Iran has built up its own capability to try to build its own weapon systems. And its industry has gotten pretty good at this, especially in terms of reverse engineering. So my suspicion is that Iran was wondering if they could get a hold of a U.S. Predator drone. Russia probably said, yeah, sure, we can get you a Predator drone. And this was an opportunity for them to try to get one, right? It was close enough to their territory. They tried to force it down into the water, which they successfully did. There is a question about Russia's naval capabilities, if they will be able to retrieve the drone. From what we understand, the drone is in at least a mile deep water. I don't know what capabilities they'll have to be able to get it out and then what of any value they'll be able to get from it. But that is my suspicion, is that they actually tried to knock this drone down so that they could copy the technology for their own use and like I said, share it with Iran, since they've already shared these other components with Iran for replication. So that's my guess. But I could be 100% wrong. So in other news, there was an air raid as well a couple of weeks ago that was played on Russian radio and TV channels, but it turned out to be a false alarm as a result of a server hack or a cyber attack. Also, interestingly, the Ukrainians used Chinese-made drones to attack Crimea during Xi's recent visit to Moscow. So that was a little bit of an on-nose approach there. And then as well...
Can you give a little color to that? Like, how did they get those drones and what, how did they know that they were using Chinese drones?
So they probably got those drones off the open market. They probably either bought them through a third-party vendor or they worked directly with a Chinese company themselves to acquire those drones. And then they... those drones, from what we understand, can take a package worth of at least 25 pounds. So they just loaded up with 25 pounds of explosives and then flew it to its target, which was a railhead in Crimea. And then the reason we know we suspect it's a Chinese drone is because of the pieces that were left over. The debris looked like they were tracked it back to, it looks like it came from this type of specific Chinese drone that's sold on the open market. This is kind of like a commercial drone. So that's how we know. So the deputy head of the Ukrainian intelligence has said that Ukraine will be ready to launch a counteroffensive, basically to cut off Russian forces from Crimea in the spring. And this has been backed up by Politico as well. They say that there's an offensive plan to begin in May and that the U.S. is prepping Ukrainian forces through training and supplies to be able to cut the land bridge that connects Russia and Crimea. There are some rumors that Ukraine might also attack Belgrade in Russia, which is in Russian territory. It's a major Russian supply depot and it's lightly defended. Although I kind of doubt that scenario because... the fact that obviously it would create a lot of tensions, especially between the West and Russia, especially if Western-made equipment is used in that attack, which would be into Russia, into Belgrade. So it would be seen as an extension or an escalation of the conflict. So I think NATO wouldn't support that. So I really doubt that. There has been some rumors that the Russian brigade that's within their Ukrainian army of basically Russian opposition forces might lead that advance into Russia proper to take Belgrade, but I doubt that as well, because it would still be seen as an escalation by Ukraine in the West. So although it's a tempting target and it's lightly defended, and it would be in a normal situation, it might be a target of opportunity. I think in this scenario, given the stakes and given we wouldn't know how Putin would respond, I doubt still he would use nuclear weapons, but we would be causing a much greater dangerous situation. I doubt the Ukrainians would do that. The other possibility is that the Ukrainians would try to encircle the Russian forces that are now around Bakhmut as a third possibility. It's interesting to see. You know, a lot of times too, we noticed last summer in the buildup to the last Ukrainian offensive, there was a little bit, they kept on talking about Kherson, and then there was an offensive around Kharkiv, right? So basically a rope-a-dope, and this might be the same situation again, or they might be playing into the fact that the Russians might think it's a rope-a-dope, and it actually isn't. So we'll have to see. I don't entirely believe, since everyone's saying it, that the attack will come, you know, to try to cut the land bridge. That does seem like the most logical move. But again, they could be trying to get the Russians off balance to hit them somewhere else.
Okay. Very good. Jeff, what about, it seems to me, especially with this attack in Belgrade, that it would be kind of perfect for Ukrainian special forces. Do the Ukrainians have a unit that would be akin to the Army Rangers or Navy SEALs, so on and so forth?
Yeah, so the Ukrainians do have special forces units, and they have been, rumor has it, have been operating both in Russia and in Crimea, and they have been attacking things. So the thing is with special forces that most of the time special forces units aren't big enough. They don't have enough personnel to take a whole city and to hold a city, right? So although they probably are already and they can cause chaos and damage and, you know, hit rail lines, things like that, they don't have the capability to take and hold large pieces of territory since those units aren't specifically designed for that.
What I'm talking about is the supply depot specifically.
Yeah, I mean they could attack the supply depots, and I'm sure that they actually are, but they could probably only hit so many, and then the thing is too that a lot of times it might be more efficient to use HIMARS depending on the context of the situation. Belgrade, like we talked about earlier, that has come under air attack via drones by Ukraine. I wouldn't be surprised at all if they had partisans and special forces moving in those areas as well to try to attack Russians' logistics and supply lines. But in terms of actually taking the town, it's probably, again, unlikely.
Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't imagine that they'd be able to take the town. Although I would think, yeah, that they would have the capability of destroying a supply depot because, you know, they're munitions and you could just set them off, or have I just watched too many 80s action films?
Well, that's true, but most of the time the Russians, I mean, again, I don't know the situation on the ground. I would assume that the Russians are having those facilities guarded to a certain extent, and then B, they probably have their supplies spread out so that they're not, you know, taken out in one big swoop, right?
Makes perfect sense. Okay, and with that, if we can move over to the political side, Jeff, if you could kick us off with sure. With Netherlands expelling the Russian diplomats.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of politics over the past month or so. The Dutch have expelled 17 Russian diplomats who they claim were actually spies. This happened a couple of days ago. And so that's some news there. In other news, Russia withdrew from the 2010 New START Treaty, which limited deployed nuclear warheads to 1,500 between the United States and Russia. So that's some dangerous news, but Russia's decided to withdraw from that treaty. This is our shortened episode. So if you want to listen to the full episode, please become a Patreon supporter at www.historyofthecoldwarpodcast.com/Patreon, or go to our website to check it out there.